You're listening to 97.3 LPFM, Richmond Independent Radio, and this is Open Source RVA. Today on Open Source RVA, we're taking our act national with a look at Governor Bob McDonald's chances at the vice presidential nod. Local political analyst Paul Goldman joins us to handicap McDonald's chances and to gaze into the crystal ball at what such a shakeup might mean to Ken Cuccinelli. Also on the program, we're talking with Bill Martin, director of the Valentine, about the city's efforts to update its wayfaring signage, a big deal for tourism. But first, Amy Daniel with the news.
Facebook users may want to hit like on an amicus brief filed this week in Richmond's Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. The brief, filed by the ACLU and attorneys for Facebook, supports an appeal by six Hampton Sheriff's Office employees. They're asking the court to overturn the ruling of U.S. Eastern District Court Judge Raymond Jackson that said hitting the like button is not protected speech. Jackson ruled earlier this year that Hampton Sheriff B.J. Roberts did not violate the free speech rights of six employees he fired after they supported his opponent in the 2009 election. One of those employees' support consisted of liking the opponent online. It's no secret there's been bad blood between Mayor Dwight C. Jones and the Richmond School Board. Jones appointed his school reform task force last March as a response to the school system's $24 million budget imbalance. But after months of pouting and posturing, it would appear that the school board is beginning to respond to the mayor's tough love approach. On Thursday, school board chairwoman Dawn C. Page sent a letter to Jones to request assistance of the task force and its efforts, she wrote, to support the community's long-range vision and goals. The letter goes on to ask for help in, among other areas, brushing up the district's public image and in petitioning the state to make changes to the composite index, a confusing formula used to determine state funding allowances to school districts. Seeking cooperation is a big departure from the past 5 months, which have been marked by bitter words toward the task force, many uttered by school board vice chairman Maurice Henderson, objecting to the mayor's efforts to intercede in school board business. A 200-year-old spinet piano currently in possession of the Virginia Governor's Mansion ranks among the most endangered artifacts in Virginia, according to the Virginia Association of Museums, which of course inspired us to ask this question. What sort of wild parties is Governor Bob McDonald throwing over there at the People's Mansion? The good news, according to Sarah Scarborough, a spokeswoman with the mansion, is that the piano is actually very safe here and in good condition. Rather, the piano's place on the list, Scarborough tells us, is because it's irreplaceable. The Association of Museums wants to know if Virginians agree, asking them to vote between now and August 29th on whether to include the piano in this year's top 10 list. Originally owned by Governor James Barber, the spinet came to the mansion in 1812 and is one of just three items dating to Virginia's post-colonial era. In lean times, priceless artifacts were auctioned off by the General Assembly to finance repairs to the mansion itself. First Lady Maureen McDonnell, in an effort to bring some of those lost items home, hosted a reception of former governors and their descendants. The event drew six living governors and the family of 39 others, many of whom donated or lent items to the mansion. We got some really cool things, Scarborough tells us. As to the piano's placement on the endangered list, the public has until August 29th to visit www.vatop10artifacts.org to vote for their favorites. Art 180's fifth annual Johnny Z Fest is this Saturday from noon to 5 p.m. Held this year in the 200 block of Shields Avenue, right in front of perennial fan institution Joe's Inn. Fun, free, and funky, not unlike the event's namesake, the Johnny Z Festival celebrates the city's creative spirit with art, music, community, and kid-friendly activities befitting Art 180's youth arts education mission. Expect a Spider-Man moon bounce and a wide variety of foods brought to you by some of the city's best food carts, as well as Joe's Inn and Shields Market.
Thanks, Amy. And one last note. The Henrico County Police Department is looking for a few good men and women. The county's Citizens and Senior Citizens Police Academies are still accepting applications, according to officials with the department's Community Policing Division, who will continue accepting those applications for about another week. The registration officially ends today. Participants, according to police department officials, learn what it's like behind the badge. More specifically, the academies offer firsthand training and demonstration of the county's crash investigations, forensic investigations, and fingerprint identification system. Also included is valuable information on crime prevention in your neighborhood, and according to the department representatives we spoke with, participants will get to spend some time on the police shooting range blasting targets. The Citizens Academy begins September 4th and runs each Monday evening from 6:30 to 9:30 through November 5th. The Senior Academy meets each Wednesday from September 5th to November 7th from 9 a.m. to noon. For information, call 501-5047 or 501-5933. Now time to handicap the VP sweepstakes. Governor Bob McDonald has been crossing the country of late, stumping for presumed Republican presidential nominee Mitt Romney. Such jet-setting is not uncommon for Republican governors in a presidential election cycle, making the rounds for their man. But as the dog days of summer approach, and more importantly, the August 27th Republican presidential convention in Tampa approaches, McDonald's trips take on a bit more significance. As a Southern governor with a whole host of positive points on his resume, budget surplus, indisputable business friendliness, claims of having reduced college tuition costs most recently, a solid military record, and excellent hair, that all makes him an attractive prospect as Romney's prospective running mate. He's Catholic, too, and he looks good to the ladies. A key demographic in this upcoming race will also play in his favor. So local political analyst and former Virginia Democratic Party chairman Paul Goldman was among the first to write on McDonald's potential for promotion, and he's here with us today to talk a little bit about whether or not we're going to lose our governor.
Hey, Chris. Good to be here.
All right. It's nice to see you, Paul. So you've written very recently. In fact, I guess today is Friday, so you wrote about this yesterday on Thursday, a little bit about what his likely chances are. And you're sort of betting against him right now.
Well, you know, you're correct, probably the first one to wrote a piece. I wrote a piece for the Richmond Times-Dispatch, ironically, comparing McDonald to Chris Christie. They were both elected governor in 2009, and they came in with a little bit of buzz. And I thought when you got to 2012 that McDonald, who was more a detailed-oriented guy, less flashy, that was part of his stick, very sort of calmly trying to go about these things, that would be a better vice presidential persona than Christie, who is much more flamboyant and new to politics, really, and untested. And
a little more of a Biden in terms of his...
Well, it's, he's from New Jersey. The Republicans won't carry New Jersey. Virginia's a key swing state for Republicans. So it seemed to me that when you did the math, McDonald made sense, and Christie would fade, but... Ironically, the way it's turned out is that the key demographic vote, you mentioned the women, and you're correct, but you could even reduce it further. It's really women, heterosexual women between 29 and 64, who don't have a four-year college degree. Now, pollsters analyze this in all different kinds of ways, and they slice and dice this, and people can take offense, but you really shouldn't. They're just trying to come up with some statistical stuff, and that is the group.
Now, is it lack of college degree, or is it a job that puts them in
No, it's lack of college degree. That's how the pollsters put it out, because they found over the years that if you sort of have a college degree, you don't have a college degree, that sort of is a way into various other things. And if you look at the way the vote's breaking out, is that basically the college degree, four-year college degree, it has to be a four-year college degree, that tends to put you in a higher income bracket and a few other things. There, the women are for the president, overwhelmingly. Hmm. If you're in that bracket, if you've got a four-year college degree, you tend to be for Romney. If you're a man, actually, any degree, even no degree, you tend to be for Romney. The group that has switched over back and forth a little bit over this period has been that 29 to 64 women without a college degree. And the younger women have stayed with Obama. The older women have tended to be a little bit more stable. And gay women have also tended to be for the president. So it's that group. And if Romney doesn't win this group, he really doesn't have any chance of being president. It's just
you're,
not
you're
enough.
Saying this is the only swing, really, that is that a we've substantial seen. Swing vote left.
That we've seen. When you have an election with an incumbent president, historically, there's always been less of an undecided vote.
But women, I mean, health care is a big issue with all women, isn't it? I mean, is this not the prevailing concern with this one segment?
Health care is a big issue, although it's so the economy is so overwhelming. Again, you're reaching the point, this is August, you're getting 90 days. And when you look at the polls, for whatever reason, just an incredible number of people have made up their mind. And I don't think they can be changed outside of some event. There's no TV commercial you're going to run that's going to change people's minds. It's not going to happen, okay? Likely that she won't be able to anything in the debates. Historically, debates have sort of reinforced people's positions. They haven't really changed things. Yes, you could have some national event, some world event, and that has happened, but that's out of people's control. So.
And here we seem to be worried about the economy being that world event.
Or, you know, you could have something to go on in the Middle East, but oftentimes that stuff could work to a president's advantage because he's in power, although it didn't work to Jimmy Carter's advantage and that long-running Iranian thing, but it did initially. Mm-hmm. So when you add the thing up and you say, well, what can happen, most of the things that could really change the election are out of the candidate's control, so let's not talk about that.
Well, so back to McDonnell and Christie. So is McDonnell, in your eyes, he's now a distant second, or is he still in the running? Is
he's on the list. I mean, oftentimes what happens with political elections or the selection of the vice president specifically is I'd say most of the time it's the last man standing. They have a list. And oftentimes the first person on the list they can't get. Why is that? That's because oftentimes the first person on the list
is
somebody who says, wait a minute, I should be the one running for president, not vice president. Also, if you run and lose as for vice president, in the modern age, no one's ever come back to be president. And so they're all calculating this. You know, and so I'm most of the time the number one person says no for that very reason. Now you're down to the list of people, and what oftentimes happens is it's the person who is least objectionable because you have a lot of groups you got to please, and oftentimes they exercise a veto. So that's where you tend to wind up. Now, what's interesting, if you look at it, the Democrats have had sort of a formula for picking a vice president. In the modern age, all but one was a senator. Oftentimes a senator who had run for president before and not done well, or a senior senator or something. That's the Democratic model. Outside of Congresswoman Geraldine Ferraro in 1984, who was admittedly a Hail Mary kind of situation, they have the four Democrats take a senator. The only other person was Sergeant Shriver in 1972 when Senator Eagleton, who was taken, mm-hmm. had to resign. Nobody wanted to run with him. He tried everybody, and they all said no because he was a dead loser by then. And
that was an awkward situation. That was different.
So the Democrats have their formula, and I always tell people if the Republicans followed the Democratic formula, they'd probably take Lamar Alexander of Tennessee, senior senator, assuming he's healthy. He's a little bit older than maybe you'd want, but he's run for president before, didn't do well. He's respected. He's a senior senator. That's what you think. Now the Republicans.
What is their formula?
They have none. The Republicans is pure chaos. If you go through it, they have taken senators, former senators, ambassadors, congressmen, former congressmen, governors, former governors. They are all over the lot. It's what's this like Forrest Gump. It's like a box
and
of chocolates.
It sounds like a used car lot.
Well, they haven't done all that well. They've had some terrible choices for vice president. By and large, the Democrats have done, outside of Ferraro, very well, or at least. But, you know, the Republicans had Nixon, got all that trouble in 1952. And then you had Agnew.
Sure.
And then you had Henry Cabot Lodge in 1960, who slept through the camp. There's a huge complaints about him. Yeah, and you had Bob Dole, who was a disaster. Quayle.
I'm Bob Dole.
Dan Quayle, who all didn't do all that well. And then, of course, you had Sarah Palin. They've had trouble. And so I think Romney wants to avoid that situation. But when you look at who he's got and what he needs, if he goes with like Tim Pawlenty, who was runner-up in McCain. He was the one, you know, it wasn't for Sarah Palin that we're going to take Puente. He ran for president, didn't do well.
Right.
But as I pointed out, oftentimes, in a strange way, that's a good thing if you want to be the vice presidential nominee. Why is that? Well, because you've been, as they say, kind of vetted.
You're an also-ran, but you've been through the process. And so, nobody found something.
Right. And so you're not gonna be a big winner, but you're not gonna be the loser. Again, you're gonna be that one thing you're trying to avoid is don't pick somebody that'll hurt me, and that's sort of the number one thing you look for. So you take somebody like
that press landmine is gonna suddenly hop out, and they've already been through the process. Is essentially what you're.
And so that's why he's number one, because he's the least objectionable of everybody. But he's not really what anybody wants. You know, Romney would think about a Rubio. I mean, he would really would want is a Jeb Bush
or
somebody.
Let me ask you. So Christie and McDonnell have really both been through this process. I mean, McDonnell's run for governor was we had some landmines pop up, and he was able to successfully maneuver around them. So he looks pretty benign in terms of how he could damage.
The national MRI that they give you is nothing like the state level.
But it seems to me, and I may be wrong here, he's gotten a little bit of a national MRI in some of the legislation that our General Assembly was dealing with.
Not helpful to him.
I know it's not helpful, but he managed not to have much of it stick to him directly.
I'm not sure. I mean, the polls are all over the lot. I think it's a little bit of a risk, but not a lot. I think McDonald is clearly not going to be a star. McDonnell is a more of a safe choice. You figure, okay, you're not going to get a big win, but you're not going to get a big loss.
Is Christie a big star, though? I mean,
Potentially. In my opinion. He's risky. He's untested, so you don't know what's there. But the reason he's a big star is he's different. McDonnell's a pop.
But sometimes what can come out of his mouth looks a little Biden-esque.
Well, that didn't hurt Biden, actually. The thing is, what Romney needs is some way to connect to the working class women, and he can't do it. He cannot do it himself. They have, you know, you look at him and they're looking at the guy and they don't want to marry him.
More recently here in Virginia, we're creating a lot of these sort of mid-level jobs, low-level jobs that are going to be available to this demographic you're talking
about.
Well,
it's, you know, what you actually have done as governor, if you look at it, I ask people, when Bill Clinton ran for president, the Democrats care what he had done in Arkansas? I mean, Arkansas was last in just about every demographic except for Mississippi. Well, that was the only reason it wasn't last.
They were jealous of Arkansas.
And so the average person doesn't really know anything about Arkansas or Massachusetts. They don't know whether there's been a good governor or a bad governor. Most people will presume, well, if you get nominated for president, you must have done a decent job as governor. They want to know what you're going to do for me. They want to hear that. And so, Christie's, you know, only been around a couple of years, but it didn't bother people with Obama. It didn't bother. Jimmy Carter got elected as a one-term governor of what was a small state.
Does Christie have any military?
No.
So
he's a prosecutor. I don't think the military really matters as much anymore.
Not going to factor in at all. I mean,
all this talk about Petraeus. Petraeus would be a disaster as a vice presidential nominee.
It was only three election cycles ago that you couldn't even begin to consider a ticket that didn't include somebody.
That's a fair question, but that's when you were in the Cold War and you could make the argument. But let's remember Ronald Reagan served in the military in sort of the actor's part. He did films. You know, he did films. And so you kind of look around. George Bush was a legitimate hero, and he was shot down. But once the fall of the Soviet Union in 1992, Clinton was elected. Now, you've got to go back, and that's a very big sort of turning point in American politics.
It's a big sea change. We all of a sudden are electing a young man. He's a baby boomer. He's
a whole different thing. But the military thing was, everyone thought that would be an issue. It wasn't. Everybody thought the thing with Paula Jones would be an issue. It really wasn't. Those are tip-offs. It takes a while to see that. But 20 years later, the country is thinking about different things. The military service is not a requirement anymore for national office.
Well, let me ask you this. Okay, so moving on to, let's presume that our right now what we're assuming is our second place candidate for vice president. McDonnell does pass muster. He does end up on the ticket. What does that do for us as a state? I mean, we're now governorless, and I mean, is he? First of all, does he? I don't recall what the requirement is. Does he have to?
No, he doesn't have to resign.
Is he likely to?
No, not going to resign. No reason to. I mean, I think the public understands that. You know, Clinton didn't resign when he ran for, and Bush didn't either. People get that. You know, the truth of the matter is they know the state can take care of itself for a couple of months. I think that Virginians will be initially kind of, I think it'll make them feel good. You know, it's been a long time since any Virginian has been on the national ticket. I mm-hmm. think you probably got to go back to what, James, maybe Polk. Well, actually, you did have, I guess you had Taylor, but in terms of a governor, who was that? It was Tippecanoe and Tyler, too. Mm-hmm. John Tyler. Mm-hmm. I think he was the last governor. That's a long time ago.
That's a very long time ago.
1840. You had Woodrow Wilson. He was born here, but he was governor of New Jersey. I think people would feel good. I think it'd be initial boost for McDonald. But in the end, McDonald is not somebody who's going to make a big splash. Now, in terms of governor, he'll probably some way make some arrangements and let Bill Bowling, the lieutenant governor, who he wants to succeed him, have a little bit more say.
And now we're getting into something that I think could be very interesting, is what does that do for Ken Cuccinelli to suddenly face an incumbent governor?
Well, first of all, McDonald's got to win, which means Romney has to win.
But let's say all the cards fall. Let's say all the cards fall.
He needs more than cards. I'll have to pull to an inside straight and then do it again.
Couple in the sleeve and
– yeah.
Right. So, but let's say that that has happened, and we're left now with Bill Bowling. Yeah, Bill Bowling.
Governor Bowling.
Governor Bowling.
Bowling alone.
Bowling alone, and bowling for dollars.
Right.
So now we have Ken Cuccinelli, who has been liking his chances in just a straight, I guess, primary sort of situation. Does he become a non-factor?
No, I would say the following. You know, Bowling get a nice boost. It's nice to be the governor, and
it's a heck of a boost.
It'll be unusual for I don't think we've ever had a sitting governor running for re-election because of the one term, and so. But I would say this: Cuccinelli would still be the favorite to win the nomination. However, if you study the history of these kinds of things around the country, if you beat an in sitting governor of your own party, you never get elected. You don't get elected.
Really?
The bad blood that you create is such that you're – not only that, remember, Bowling is still the governor, seething. And what's he going to help Cuccinelli get elected? For what reason
Probably
exactly?
Probably not campaigning for him.
I would think behind the scenes he will do whatever it takes to stop Cuccinelli from being governor. It's the worst thing for Cuccinelli.
So does Cuccinelli set aside for four? It's not his time, another 4 years?
If he's got any political sense, he will. As I say, Bowling can get to be governor, but it's really not going to make a lot of the conservatives love him anymore. That's just the way it is. They like Cuccinelli. So if Cuccinelli's insistent, he can force it. Plus, Bowling is going to try to govern more like McDonald and sort of keep a little distance between some of the conservatives, and so he's only going to anger them. But if you're Cuccinelli, you got to realize beating the governor of your own party is really a ticket to losing in November. And then, you know, then you're out of office totally. I would suggest that Cuccinelli will run for attorney general again and live to fight another day.
So now, I guess, last but not least, Bowling, with his elevation.
He'd be tough to beat. Yeah, I mean, you know, he's an incumbent governor.
And we're talking here about the Democrat running against
him. Yeah, you're running against an incumbent governor. That's new. People are going to be kind of fascinated by it, right? Because we've never seen that. It's very unusual in politics that you get something new. He can actually campaign as the governor. He's going to have the state police, all this stuff around him. You know, kind of he's the governor. You get to do that kind of stuff. He can raise an amazing amount of money as an incumbent governor. Plus, in order to be governor, you got Romney and McDonald in the White House. That's the only way that happens. So he's got some huge money and friends coming out of the White House. You know, as I say, they're going to – Cuccinelli's going to –
Sort of a weird coattails effect potential.
He is a, you know, the biggest winner of a Rom – I guess the two – it's ironic, but the two biggest winners would be two Virginians. It would be McDonald and it would be Bowling, and the biggest loser would probably be Cuccinelli outside of the president. As I say, it's a nice fantasy and it's it'd make a nice novel, but – it's, you know, you would really, you got to, first you got to get McDonald, the Veep thing, and that's a long shot. And then you got to have Romney win. That's another long shot. So when you kind of multiply it out, you'd probably do better playing the lottery.
Like you said, fiction. Well, thank you, Paul, for
coming in
today and talking and writing a little bit of fiction for us about the upcoming election and the following governor election. So thank you very much, Paul.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Open Source RVA, and my name is Don Harrison. I'm a longtime freelance writer and editor. You've seen my work locally in Style Weekly, Richmond Magazine, and a host of other media, and I will be one of the weekly co-hosts here on Open Source RVA. I'm here with Bill Martin, the director of the Valentine Richmond History Center, and we're talking signs. Martin has been among the area cultural stakeholders working with the City of Richmond to update and completely overhaul Richmond's road and pedestrian signage. That's the signs you'd find directing drivers and tourists to such attractions as Maymont, the Black History Museum, the Museum of the Confederacy, Center Stage, and of course, the Valentine History Center. Thanks for coming and talking about this.
Absolutely. Congratulations on the show.
Well, thank you. Can I call you Bill?
I think you better.
Okay. Updating Richmond signage has actually been on your radar for a long time. You told me that friends will actually email you pictures of signs from across the country. Is that just you being a wonk, or is that...
No. I think that I've served on the Convention and Visitors Board for a number of years, and really I've been thinking about how do we control the visitor's experience. When from the moment someone comes off the interstate... Mm-hmm. How do we create a memorable experience, an easy-to-navigate experience for that visitor? We say we're about tourism. And if we're about tourism, we need to get the things that are on the street right.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's a lot of things. I mean, certainly it is great signage. And I think when you come off the interstate now onto Broad Street, if someone wants to find Center Stage,
right,
there's not a sign, really.
Yeah, and it doesn't make much sense to be building all these great things and then not telling people where they are.
You know,
right?
with the landmark. You know, all of those things that these cultural amenities, these really important projects for the city, whether it's baseball or theaters, there are these places that we want tourists and residents to come and experience, and we need to make it simple and easy and well understood. And that it's from signage, but it's also identifying parking.
Mm-hmm.
So that as part of anything we do, it's the signs, it's parking, identifying and clearly marking parking, but it's also the streetscape itself. It's making sure that the streets look clean, are well maintained.
Mm-hmm.
It's really creating that street level experience for the visitor, and those details are the devil's in the details. And I think that that's where the next work that we need to do in developing tourism really is.
Well, how long has it been since we last updated Richmond signage?
Well, there was a partial project in 2007. And so in just downtown, there are some red, white, and blue signs.
Mm-hmm.
It's fairly limited number of blocks for the implementation of that plan so that you can see hints of what was to be a comprehensive signage system for the city from 2007 so that the visitors for Jamestown would be able to get into the city.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to go much further back, at least 15 years, to find the last comprehensive signage program. And I think people will see them around town now. They're sort of the blue and white with green. In fact, someone, they do send me pictures. Someone sent me a picture today of a sign that still remains for Sixth Street Marketplace.
Oh my gosh.
So that there are these multiple layers. So part of this idea is it's not putting up new signs. It's actually simplifying things so that I'm more excited about taking down multiple layers of overlapping and contradictory signs that provide sort of the wayfinding through the city. So it's a big project. It's a huge project and pretty complex because you do have one-way streets, you do have changing street patterns, new projects. So it's not the easiest thing to do.
Right, right. Well, you were kind enough to let me ride around with you one day for a story I was doing that's published in this month's issue of Richmond Magazine, and I was actually quite astonished by the state of the signage. I don't only noted it in passing before. There were faded out signs hidden by telephone poles. How did we let it get this bad?
I'm really not sure, because I think everyone agrees that this is one of those simple, probably and costly projects that need to get done if we're truly going to be ready for 2015 with the bike race, if we're going to really invite people into the city for a variety of projects, whether it's the new visitor center and the improvements at Main Street Station, whether it's getting people to the VMFA. There are all these projects, and I think particularly over the next few years, we're going to see a lot of investment in the cultural sector. So you've got improvements at the Landmark. You've got improvements at Historic Tredegar. The Virginia Historical Society is doing things. We're doing things. Maymont's doing things. And so there are lots and lots of projects that are coming online that we hope people will enjoy. And so making sure that we have the infrastructure in place to support those improvements is really important. Because, you know, and we've talked about this before, we really do. I mean, if you think about Richmond compared to other places of similar size, there is this amazing wealth of cultural resources from museums, historic sites, theaters, music venues, and heaven help if you want to get to the Arts District on Broad Street. I mean, if you're coming to First Friday, where is it and where do you park? And so it's just that, just the simple things.
Right, and also it was pointed out that it's not only tourists that'll benefit. It's also people that live here in the Metro Richmond area that may just not know where these things are.
I think we assume if we're in downtown that everyone knows where everything is. And if you look at the tourism numbers, what we do know is that the number one tourist coming to Richmond are coming to visit friends and family. So if you know that's the case, then the people that you really want to convince are the residents of the city and the residents of the region. So that person who's living in Brandermill, who has friends visiting, they want to come. They want to show off the city, but they're not going to show off the city because you don't want to be embarrassed in front of your family and get lost. So you want to make it as easy as possible, and so creating this sense of safety, comfort, ease is, quite frankly, it's just as important, maybe more important for the residents of the region than it is for tourists.
Things got so bad that Ralph White, the director of the James River Park System, actually started making his own signs. And you noted on our drive that the VMFA also made its own signs.
Well, I think there have been these independent efforts, sort of short of a comprehensive system, that folks have said, we're building a new building. We've got this new museum opening. We need people to find where we are. Ralph was amazing in making sure that some of the slave sites that had been ignored for generations were marked until the only comprehensive signage system that's in place is one that's there for the slave trail.
Oh, really? Okay.
And if you're for the walking experience, it is the slave trail at least has signage marking the principal sites. Now it's not connected, so that if you don't have a map in your hand, you're not necessarily going to know where the next stop is. But in terms of actually place identifiers, Slave Trail is the only well identified, the sites are well identified experience that a visitor can come to Richmond and do at this point.
Right.
And yet we got all this great stuff. We've got all this great stuff that's actually easily within walking distance. We don't always think about Richmond as a walkable place.
Right, right.
Because, if you live here, you can't imagine that you would walk, that you're able to walk from St. John's Church, Holocaust Museum, do the Canal Walk, do the American Civil War Center, do Maggie Walker, all the sites in Jackson Ward, do the things that are in Court Inn where the Valentine is, Museum of the Confederacy, John Marshall House, Monumental Church, and you can do all of that in less than 10K.
Right, right. When we were on our drive along for the Richmond Magazine piece, you and I noted several clusters of tourists at intersections, sort of staring blankly at maps. You said that that's a downtown site that you see all the time.
Well, it's an exciting site.
Yeah, I like
because
to see it.
It's one of the ways you can clearly identify a tourist, because they all have the exact, they all receive the map from the Convention and Visitors Bureau at the visitor centers. And so you've got this, they've got the map, but, you know, that map needs reinforcement. Mm-hmm. We also need to think about new technologies. We need to have GPS systems that actually support people's visits. So there's lots of things that could be done to enhance in a variety of ways that visitor's experience.
You're listening to Open Source RVA. My name is Don Harrison, and we're with Bill Martin, director of the Valentine History Center, and we're talking signs. Bill, I understand there's been some movement on the issue in recent months. We actually have a plan.
There is a plan, and it's exciting that there's now movement. The city, several years ago, identified this as a priority, set aside funds, initial funds to do the project. A consultant was hired probably a year ago, maybe a little over a year ago now, to really dig deep into that. They've met with all the stakeholders.
And this was the 212?
It's a company.
A company out of New York. They did Charlotte's signage.
They've done signage programs all over the country. And again, I think there was probably this sense, well, oh, you know, hey, Mickey, hey, Judy, let's go put up a sign. And this is really a very complex deal. And so it's creating a hierarchy of signs from here's when you get off the interstate to here's where you turn, your car needs to turn to get into the Valentine or to get into a parking lot where you can walk. There's the site identifiers, and then there's the additional information on each of the sites that normally places have. So there's this hierarchy of signs that need to be developed. And, you know, coming up with a design is, because we have a lot of really amazingly qualified and talented artists in the
city. Talk a little bit about the process that had to be seen in order for any movement to be made. You had to get, first of all, you had to get the other museums and cultural institutions on board.
And the city called meetings with all the cultural stakeholders to sort of begin to think about it. There were individual meetings with neighborhoods. And then, you know, there was a presentation. And I think that when you finally get that, here's what it's going to look like. At some point, you just have to say, this is what it's going to look like.
Right, right.
And that's hard for creative people. It's just...
Everybody's got an idea, right?
Everyone's got an idea, and their idea is going to be better. And what it has to take someone like the city, who has the resources, to exert that, said, this is what we're going to do. Because what you don't want to do is create a signage system that 5 years from now or tomorrow is dated because it's connected to some tourism campaign.
Right.
Or
we discussed if Easy to Love
I think there was certainly a move to put RVA on the signs, but that's really sort of if it had been Easy to Love or a thousand other identity systems that
or
have
Get
been,
Off Richmond
or Get Off, you know. Actually, that might have been better. I would have gone for Get Off Richmond,
because you could just see that on the highway, right?
I think those are the kinds of things we need to do. I think we need to have a much more of a sense of humor about how we promote the city.
Do you think Virginia's for Lovers would fly today?
Because
even that could be construed as controversial.
I'm not sure that we would do Virginia's for Lovers today.
An amazing success story for Virginia. It should be noted that. this will reportedly cost $3 million, the new signage system?
I've not seen the final estimates, but I think that it could be potentially that costly because that's full implementation. Mm-hmm. And you've got to remember, there are a lot. It seems like a lot of money. But you've got this fairly complex set of signs that have to be, if they're going to last, they have to be really well constructed.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes a lot of, that's an expensive process. But it's also, it's creating the little signs. And I think that's where the money comes in. If you're going to actually create walking signs, mm-hmm. you have to put them up fairly often so that people have connectors. So if you're walking, say, from the visitor center at the convention center,
right.
and they're walking, say, Franklin
You have to continue to guide yeah. them.
You have to continue to guide them. So you have to continue to provide that reinforcement. So it's not just a matter of the big highway signs. Mm-hmm. It really is this extra layer and layer and layer of signs. And that takes some time.
Well, this new overhaul will also address the parking problem, you said. Now, that's really exciting news.
Well, I think there's an inventory of downtown parking. So what they are hoping to do is where there are public parking lots available to make sure that they're well marked. Because
mm-hmm.
I think the city in there has determined with the inventories that they've done of parking that there may be enough parking spaces mm-hmm. in downtown, but they're very difficult to find.
Also, you want people parking, I guess, where they can go to multiple venues.
Right, and that's the other thing. We need to encourage, if when you go to New York or another city, you don't think twice about parking your car and walking.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And yet, as Richmonders, I don't think we think about Richmond as a place that you would park your car and walk.
Hmm.
And yet you can get from the Valentine and our neighborhood to the new ICA. That is less than a 15, 20-minute walk.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's not that far.
But this initially, they were going to have tests of this new overhaul coming this month. Apparently that's been held back for a little while because of a glitch in the... I guess, the contract with the company making the signs for the
right.
city.
What we've heard is that the initial implementation will begin this fall. With
You're smiling.
I'm smiling.
You've seen and heard this
I
before.
I am going to be there
mm-hmm.
when the first sign goes in. I will just tell you. The system is to begin with the museums on the boulevard.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be that neighborhood extending from the interstate out to Maymont will be the first set of institutes.
No, I think I know, but why would you do the boulevard first? Why wouldn't you address the real, what would they say, the problem, the downtown problem?
Well, I think it's not a bad idea to test it there
mm-hmm.
because it's a little bit more straightforward. Because you get off the interstate and there's essentially a corridor with institutions arrayed along it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, one turn to the Children's Museum and the Science Museum.
Yeah.
Now, I will tell you that as you do these things, you also have to think about making it easier for people. And when we did our ride, we noticed you can't turn left off of Broad Street onto the boulevard.
Right, right.
So it's not just about the signs. It's about making sure
that... And it's also an area that's got a lot of accidents, coincidentally.
It does. And, you know, maybe allowing a left turn there and signalizing or something, doing whatever traffic engineers do.
Mm-hmm.
Really, it's very difficult if you're trying to get from Broad Street. If you actually visit the Valentine and go up Broad Street mm-hmm. and are going to the VMFA or the Historical Society...
Yeah, you don't know the little tricks we do.
You don't know the little tricks. There is a sign that says go off to on a smaller street. But if you're from out of town, I'm not sure that I would make mm-hmm. that turn,
right.
even though there's a sign.
And you and I, we were near a parking lot and saw a car do just that, sort of stop abruptly, kind of see what was going on. If they had a sign that was more clearly marked,
mm-hmm.
that wouldn't have happened. You're listening to Open Source RVA. I'm Don Harrison, and we're talking signs with Bill Martin from the Valentine History Center. Tell me more about First of all, do we have the money to pay for this? My understanding was that there was only $1 million squirreled away.
There's a million set aside for the project. I think there's been about $200,000 or a little over $200,000 spent on the design and consulting services. What I do believe is that we will need to find additional funding. I believe that while it may not be $2 million, I believe that all of the sites along the routes that will be marked, all of them have some responsibility to assist in helping pay for the signage system. I think that we, the Valentine, mm-hmm. we would love to have signs that actually talk about what we do right. in front of the building. We would find the resources to do those signs. And I think that that's always been on the table, mm-hmm. that whether it's the VMFA or Maymont, that given a proposal that all the institutions would potentially participate in helping the funding. Now, I'm not sure we're going to find $2 million. In fact, I'm certain we're not going to find $2 million in the current environment. But there would be some funding, the private support, to do some of the signage. But it's a big number. It's a big number, and I think the plan at this point is to do the vehicular signs first, then move down to sort of site signs, and then the walking material would
right.
come,
that would be, come last.
That would come last, and so my guess is that happens. That may not happen.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You may spend it all before you get there.
You will spend it all before you get there. But mm-hmm. at least, but what will be in place is a system that if the city wants to continually invest in upgrading the mm-hmm. signage system, and it really ought to be a part of the regular city budget, that there are continuing improvements, because the notion that we're going to put the system up mm-hmm. and that it's never going to need to be changed is part of the problem that we have now.
Have you heard when we are supposed to implement the overhaul of the signage system, the new, now that we've had this little hiccup?
This fall. It's going to be this. The last I heard was fall for the Boulevard mm-hmm. and then spring for the downtown sites. Downtown's going to be an interesting
Talk about that challenge, because I don't think people really think about that, how challenging just the traffic flow is.
Well, you've got this inconsistent system of one-way streets, and you have streets that have been blocked so that you don't have, in places, the natural grid of the city mm-hmm. has been interrupted, which confuses visitors. And then you just have a lot of properties. You have a lot of really amazing things. So you've got Center Stage, you've got, you know, all the wonderful things in Jackson Ward. You've got the river mm-hmm. and the American Civil War Center and Historic Tredegar. You've got the Virginia War Memorial, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and then you've got us. I mean, we've got the Library of Virginia, you've got the National, and I think that there are some for-profit venues that, because of their appeal, that we need to have in place some system mm-hmm. for music venues, large music venues
right.
like the National mm-hmm. That ought to be included. But if you begin to think about it, how many of those things are downtown, and how do you develop this hierarchy that guarantees it? Because there's some signs now that make no sense. You've got
signs to things that aren't even open to the public.
Things that are not even open. You have signs to sites that are really... The first tee, mm-hmm. for instance, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. has regular tourism signs.
Right.
First tee is not exactly something that, the way I would think about this, would be something that would have tourism signs. And mm-hmm. so they've been sort of, there needs to be this consistent system so that you have to be open to the public X number of days. Mm-hmm. You need to have regular hours.
To attract a certain number of people, maybe?
Maybe attract, and that will determine which hierarchy, what level of signage that mm-hmm. you might get. So I think that there are ways of doing it. They've certainly been done in other places, but there is no doubt about it. Downtown is significantly more complex because you have the density. I mm-hmm. mean, along the boulevards, you have Science Museum, Children's Museum, Historical Society, VMFA, and Maymont. That's it.
Right.
We have five sites, individual sites, just in our little neighborhood.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I understand that the New York firm who is doing the design work, 212, actually commented that they couldn't believe just how many attractions we had in the downtown area, such a small
Right, area. And I think that the chamber did their intercity visit this year, went to Boston. Mm. And it was intriguing.
Did you go along?
I did go along.
Okay.
And, you know, they've got the American Revolution. They got it.
Mm-hmm.
That's great.
Yeah, they got some things going on there.
They got some things going on. And they have something called the Freedom Trail that's there that sort of connects their sites. It's about a 3-mile
They have my beloved Boston Celtics.
They do. And, but we've got squirrels.
Yeah.
Don't forget the squirrels.
No, I will not.
But
if we have a new Shaco Bottom Stadium for the squirrels, you think we'll get a sign for it?
No comment. No, I think by that point there will be a signage system. But what we do have in downtown is the opportunity to tell the entire American story.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not – Boston's has that concentration on, right. on the colonial and revolutionary period and early national period. But suddenly you get to Richmond and you can go from the Revolution with Patrick Henry – you can see Native American sites. You can do the slave story that we don't do as well as we need to do. Mm-hmm. But you can also do Civil War. You can do the founding of the Republic with Jefferson's Capitol. You can move up through time looking at industry. But we've got Maggie Walker and Jackson Ward. Mm-hmm. You can do music history from from the Hippodrome over to all the theaters that existed on Broad Street. So you've got all of those things that you can do that is a bigger, a much, much bigger story. And it's a much bigger story, and I'm going to get killed.
You're trying to pick a fight with Boston.
Oh, no, I'm not trying to pick a fight. It's about more than the Civil War. That Richmond certainly has great Civil War resources. But it also has this unique ability, I think, among East Coast cities because of the number of buildings that we have, historic structures that remain in place, to tell this really broader narrative of the American experience. And that's a really important opportunity. And when we look at the concentration of National Historic Landmarks, which is something I always look at, there are 17 National Historic Landmarks in Richmond. 15 of those landmarks are within walking distance downtown. Mm-hmm. And that's an odd mix. It's Maggie Walker, but it's also Ellen Glasgow.
Right, right.
It's the Main Street Station and St. John's Church.
Yeah, we have a lot more stories.
Yeah, we have a lot more stories than we've traditionally allowed ourselves to tell. And then there's the things that are happening today. You know, within the art scene, I think, really remarkable music. It's happening occasionally around town.
Yeah, I've heard about it.
There's some good art, and that this is a continuing evolving story that we don't necessarily do the kind of job we need to do.
Yeah, it must be noted that we left messages for Mark Olinger, the director for the city's planning and development department, seeking a statement on where the project stands. From what we've gathered, however, the city contract with the company manufacturing the signs, that contract ran out. So right now we're just looking at a hiccup in the process, or is this really this will take us off track?
I think it's a hiccup. I think that there's a lot of pressure. The signs are done, and we just need to make sure that happens.
Great. Well, thanks a lot for coming in today.
Sure, absolutely.
We've been talking to Bill Martin, the director of the Valentine Richmond History Center. We've been talking to him about signs here on Open Source RVA.
And that just about wraps it up this week, Friday, August 10th, 2012, for Richmond's Weekly News Digest, Open Source RVA. We're already hard at work on next week's show, when we plan to talk about bikes and baseball and probably some other stuff yet undreamed of as twilight descends on River City. Remember, you're listening to WRIR 97.3 LPFM. As we leave you this week, we dedicate our sign-off song to our board op, Rachel Solomon.